From NPR and WBUR, I'm Lisa Mullins.
I'm Eric Westervelt. It's Here and Now. The president is in Florida today, where he's touting Republican tax cuts. But he spent the morning ripping into former FBI Director James Comey. The attacks have escalated since Comey gave an exclusive interview over the weekend about his upcoming book to ABC News' George Stephanopoulos. Here's how Comey described the president.
A person who sees moral equivalence in Charlottesville, who talks about and treats women like they're pieces of meat, who lies constantly about matters big and small and insists the American people believe it, that person's not fit to be president of the United States.
Meanwhile, the president's personal lawyer, Michael Cohen, is in court today. He says records the FBI seized in his office should be protected by attorney-client privilege, and the U.S. government is considering more sanctions against Russia over its support for Syria. NPR's Ron Elving joins us now. Hi, Ron.
Hey, Eric. Good to be with you.
So James Comey, he did not mince words in his description of the president. He even compares Trump to a mafia boss. It's incredible to hear a former FBI director described a sitting president in this way. But did we learn anything new, Ron, from the ABC News interview?
Not if you read the book or if you saw any of the many reviews and stories about it in the news. There are actually quite a number of gangster comparisons in the actual book. But with the ABC interview, of course, far more people saw that than are likely to read the book. So a lot of people may be shocked to hear this kind of talk coming from a guy who's been in top-level jobs in three different presidential administrations, in both political parties, FBI director, deputy attorney general in the George W. Bush administration, a top U.S. attorney before that. So it's shocking. If you've followed this particular fellow, James Comey, over the years, you know how hard he has tried to be seen as nonpartisan, the model G-man who cared only about the integrity of the process.
Very interesting and shocking in many ways. I mean, Comey wrote the book while the special counsel's investigation is still ongoing, Ron. I mean, doesn't that book put, you know, him and his former colleagues at the FBI in a tough spot?
It would seem to play into the narrative we're hearing from the president and his minions about how the FBI and others in the Department of Justice hatched a conspiracy to rob him, President Trump, of his election victory of 2016. But for Comey personally, you know, this really is his moment. When he and his publisher worked out this schedule, they had no idea where exactly things would stand at this point. But they did know they wanted to put Jim Comey's side of the story before the nation as soon as possible. That has to do with sales, as well as political impact and exoneration for Mr. Comey.
Ron, what do you make of the White House's response to this book and the ABC interview? I mean, the Republican National Committee and the White House have slammed it. Polls have shown the public is split on James Comey. Why fire back on Twitter and elsewhere against Comey all the time?
To some degree, there has been a measured response from the White House more generally. But the president himself clearly is following his long-standing dictum that if someone hits you, you should hit back 10 times harder. And so tweet after tweet after tweet in sometimes fusillades of six and seven at a time, the president has been calling Comey a slime ball and saying he was only trying to get a job with Hillary Clinton when he made certain decisions having to do with her email investigation in 2016. So he has certainly demonstrated that in terms of the characterization of his dignity in Mr. Comey's book, Mr. Comey may have been onto something.
Ron, you've read the book. Is there anything, you know, in the book that didn't get on the ABC interview that you find relevant, interesting, or worth talking about?
There is a great deal of material in the book that was not in the interview that has to do with Mr. Comey's own life. Most of the book, two-thirds of the book, has nothing to do with Donald Trump. It all takes place before he ever met Donald Trump or before he actually even came to Washington. It has to do with his early life, experiences in high school and college, law school, things that he did in his early years as a U.S. attorney when he worked for Rudy Giuliani in Manhattan, and some of the things that he learned investigating the mafia about that particular social subculture. There's quite a bit of interesting material, but it's obviously there to set up the believability of the judgments that Comey makes later in the book.
Let's switch to Syria a bit. President Trump authorized missile strikes in Syria over the weekend in retaliation for alleged chemical weapons attack by the Syrian government. Here's UN Ambassador Nikki Haley on Fox News Sunday explaining the rationale for the attack on Syria.
Assad knew that Russia had his back. Assad knew that Russia would cover for him at the United Nations. And Assad got reckless, and he used it in a way that was far more aggressive. We have to be very conscious of the fact that we can't allow even the smallest use of chemical weapons. That's why you saw the president strike this past weekend.
Haley says the U.S. is preparing more sanctions against Russia for its support of Assad's government. But, Ron, I mean, could sanctions or this weekend's strike, will it do anything to really change the horrible dynamic on the ground in Syria?
You know, 100 Tomahawk missiles is not just a calling card. And that strike may have degraded the chemical weapons capability of the Syrians. However, it is not likely to alter the course of the civil war in Syria, the war itself, or to lessen the Russian commitment there. Even with the horrific provocation of these chemical attacks, and despite that Allied response, this was ultimately a very limited action that left the status quo very much intact in Syria. And that was clearly intentional. This president is no more willing than his predecessors to invest in actually ousting Bashar al-Assad.
That's NPR's Ron Elving, senior editor and correspondent for NPR's Washington desk. Ron, thank you very much.
Thank you, Eric.
The U.S. Supreme Court will hear arguments tomorrow in a case that could have a huge impact on businesses across the country. The case is South Dakota versus Wayfair, and it pits more than 40 states that impose a sales tax against the handful that don't. New Hampshire is one of the states with no sales tax. So we asked New Hampshire Public Radio's Todd Bookman to talk about the money that's at stake.
This Supreme Court case is all about how sales taxes are collected when a business in one state sells its product to a customer in another state. So, as an example, let's use a Dover, New Hampshire company, Nemo Equipment. They make high-end camping gear, like tents.
And so this would be a two-person tent that we have here. And
Lorcan LaFleur is chief financial officer for Nemo.
You know, this is used for various backpacking adventures that, you know, and this is one of our highest selling products.
Since I live in New Hampshire, if I go to Nemo's website and buy this tent, I don't have to pay sales tax because New Hampshire doesn't have one. But if I lived in South Dakota, a state with a sales tax, and I ordered this tent online from Nemo, should I expect to pay South Dakota's sales tax?
Currently, you would not be charged sales tax because we are a New Hampshire-based business.
What LaFleur means is because Nemo Equipment doesn't have any offices in South Dakota, no warehouses, no retail outlets, Nemo doesn't have to collect a sales tax on behalf of South Dakota. It's been this way since 1967. The Supreme Court ruled back then, in a case involving mail order catalog companies, that as long as the business doesn't have a, quote, physical presence in the state, it doesn't have to collect a sales tax there. In 1992, the Supreme Court reaffirmed the so-called physical presence rule. But today, mail order has been replaced by e-commerce. So South Dakota and the 44 other states with a sales tax, they aren't just losing out on a few catalog transactions. They're losing out on tax revenue from a huge number of online transactions.
And so this is really billions of dollars of revenue that is not changing hands.
This is Ian Samuel, a Harvard Law School lecturer who's closely watching the case of South Dakota versus Wayfair. Wayfair is an online retailer, but the end result of this case wouldn't just apply to them. It could force all businesses to start collecting online sales tax when their customers live in a state with one.
What South Dakota is saying in this case is it has become a really big deal. And so it's no longer possible to just tolerate this mistake if the court does think it's a mistake.
41 states, along with the Trump administration, have filed legal briefs in support of South Dakota. They say there's too much lost tax revenue to let this stand. So that's one side. On the other, there are retailers like eBay and Etsy, and the five states with no sales tax, including New Hampshire. They say it would be a huge burden to force businesses to calculate the no-joke thousands of different state, county, and local sales taxes that exist nationwide, that it would force small businesses to buy software and hire extra bookkeepers just to try to comply. With the backing of Governor Chris Sununu, the New Hampshire Attorney General filed a brief in this case. Assistant AG Anthony Galdieri says if the rules changed, companies in New Hampshire would find the tax reporting requirements overwhelming.
And the last thing we need is for our small businesses to say the risk and uncertainty of doing business over the internet is just too high. I can't afford to do it. And they may very well go out of business if they can't do that.
They argue this issue is best left not to the courts, but to Congress. And Congress has debated this topic in recent years. Senator Gene Shaheen says one sticking point has always been how to treat states like hers that don't have any tax revenue on the line.
For us in New Hampshire, we would get no benefit from this. And so what we've argued is that we should be exempt.
With no legislative fix in sight, for now, all eyes are on the Supreme Court. Ian Samuel with Harvard Law says the stakes in this case are sizable.
I mean, it may not rise to the level of, you know, Bush v. Gore, but it's a biggie for sure. And I think people are going to be paying very close attention to it.
The 45 states that have a sales tax certainly will. So will the five that don't. For Here and Now, I'm Todd Bookman.
It's the third straight day of protests at a Starbucks store in Philadelphia following last week's arrest of two black men. A customer took a viral video on Thursday that showed the men getting arrested after an employee claimed they were trespassing. The video's gotten more than 10 million views on Twitter and counting, and in this clip, you can hear the voice of a man demanding to know why police are arresting his friends.
What did they get called for? Because there are two black guys sitting here meeting me?
Yes, I didn't know that.
Well, what did they do? What did they do? Did someone tell me what they did?
The men were held for 8 hours before prosecutors said there was no evidence of any crime. WHYY reporter Peter Crimmins is in Philadelphia covering today's protests. And Peter, what was the protest scene like today at Starbucks?
Well, this is a second protest. There was a protest over the weekend, and there was another one today. And they're put on by two different organizations. Over the weekend, it was Black Lives Matter. And today, it was Real Justice and Black and Brown Workers Collaboration. And on the surface, they have similar demands. They want the employees of Starbucks to be fired, and they want the police officers who did the arrest to be fired. But today, it seems like what they were really going for is to simply to shut down Starbucks. They arrived there at about 7 o'clock. The protest lasted from 7 o'clock to 10 o'clock, which is the prime coffee drinking hours. That's when people go out and get their coffee. And they Starbucks was clearly prepared for this because once the protesters entered the building, all the employees, all the baristas left the premises. No customers came in. This was an event that was posted on Facebook, so people they knew it was coming, and they occupied Starbucks for 3 hours, and they effectively shut it down. And it's my understanding that Starbucks will not open today. They will be doing no business today, and that was what the protesters were hoping for.
And what's happened to this manager at the store that called the police on these two men who, according to the video, were just hanging out waiting for their friend? What's happened to this manager?
It's my understanding that the manager is no longer working at that Starbucks. It's unclear if the manager was fired or just simply transferred somewhere else, but no longer at that location at the very least.
We'll have to leave it there. WHYY reporter Peter Crimmins from Philadelphia. Thank you, Peter.
Sure thing.
Russia has the largest number of nuclear weapons in the world. The United States is not too far behind. The two countries control 90% of all nuclear warheads. Well behind them are France, China, the UK, Pakistan, India, and finally North Korea. With so much attention focused on North Korea's nuclear capabilities, we're going to take a look now at the spread of weapons and the successful reining in of nuclear programs. We've asked Siegfried Hecker to help us take stock. He is senior fellow at the Center for International Security and Cooperation. Thank you, Professor, for joining us.
Lisa, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here with you.
The landmark nuclear nonproliferation treaty, known as the NPT, was negotiated and signed 50 years ago. At the time, there was a major arms race going on. I wonder if you could first compare that to now. Countries don't seem to be quite as motivated by the numbers in their nuclear stockpile, developing as many nukes as they possibly can. Are they now?
Well, first of all, I mean, the main arms race was really between the U.S. And the Soviet Union. However, back in that time, 50 years ago, there was concern that perhaps we would have 25 countries go nuclear. Turns out that's not happened. However, in the nuclear business, you don't need many nuclear bombs. You don't need many nuclear countries, and therefore it is still a problem. So the issues are very different, still very serious, but nowhere near what they were 50 years ago.
Yeah, I'm going to pick up on what you mentioned there about how you don't need that many nuclear bombs. It's a matter of how many countries have them. And there used to be a bumper sticker that said one nuclear bomb can ruin your whole day. So where do the numbers come in? I mean, we hear both from Russia and from the United States that there are interests in updating, modernizing the nuclear stockpile. Tell us if that means adding to the stockpile and why. I mean, we're talking about thousands and thousands of nuclear weapons on both sides.
Well, actually, both countries indeed still have thousands of nuclear weapons. However, both countries are also modernizing. And in addition, you know, President Putin has really decided that he's going to demonstrate to the United States that no matter what it does with missile defense, that the Russian nukes can get us. And so he's shown off in the last couple of months some monstrous new nuclear capabilities, like a big nuclear torpedo and then a new ICBM, intercontinental ballistic missile. Do they need that? I don't think so. What does the U.S. do? Of course, we have to respond. And so that's actually one of the very unfortunate things. Things went in a direction from what I would call confrontation to collaboration after the Cold War. We worked together for 25 years to try to make the world a safer place, and now it's going in the other direction. That needs attention. And in my opinion, it's not getting sufficient attention today from our government.
President Trump has escalated his own rhetoric on nuclear arms, tweeting about how he has a bigger button on his desk than Kim Jong-un of North Korea and talking about building up the U.S. arsenal. I want to ask you something that's not a rhetorical question, but how many nuclear weapons does a country really need?
Well, the way that the U.S. has always put it, we need to have enough to be able to deter the other side. So when the other side was the Soviet Union, you know, the governments decided they actually needed tens of thousands. You know, as you look back now, that seems absolutely crazy. And the number of nuclear weapons have gone down by some 85% since the end of the Cold War.
I mean, that sounds like good news, but you're still sort of sounding the alarm.
So we still have thousands of nuclear weapons. That's too many nuclear weapons. And the U.S. and Russia should be working in a direction of getting rid of more of those nuclear weapons.
If the U.S. and Russia have the vast majority, we understand the concerns about North Korea, but what are the other countries that you think we should be paying attention to?
Well, the one that I'm most worried about is a potential nuclear confrontation between India and Pakistan. And those two countries, since their birth, which was like 70 years ago, they have been in confrontation ever since. They're building up their nuclear capabilities. Their numbers are still much lower. They're on the level of 100 or so. However, they're both diversifying those weapons, the triad, which would be land, air, and also underwater. That diversification, combined with the possibility of them developing battlefield nuclear weapons, lowers the nuclear threshold in a place in the world that's quite a dangerous place. So that's one of my biggest concerns, and it turns out the United States is extremely important as a mediator to the conflicts that are there in South Asia, namely India, Pakistan.
How about Iran in terms of, I mean, at this point, Iran is not known as a nuclear power, but the Iran nuclear deal was negotiated to keep the country from developing nuclear weapons. President Trump has criticized the deal. Do you think that it's an effective way of deterring Iran from obtaining nuclear arms?
Well, from a technical standpoint, that deal was better than anything that I expected. It put intrusive inspections in place that would give us insurance that they're not moving closer to the bomb. The difficulty with Iran, for the most part, and I think the administration is really worried about that, there are lots of things that Iran does outside of the nuclear arena, which are very troublesome for the United States. As far as the nuclear deal is concerned, it's better, whatever problems we have in the Middle East, that those problems are faced without a nuclear Iran. And that's what I think the deal does. So we should stick with it.
I think we should note as well, there are some real success stories about the dismantling of nuclear weapons, about countries giving up their nuclear programs. Give us the kind of highlights. I mean, there's Libya, there's South Africa. Tell us what you think is the most noteworthy.
The most important success is that rather few countries have pursued them. That's the most important. In terms of getting rid of nuclear weapons, the most significant one is South Africa, that had actually built six nuclear devices and then in the early 1990s decided to give it up. The other examples, of course, is the other former states of the Soviet Union, namely Ukraine, Belarus, and Kazakhstan.
Because they inherited the USSR's weapons.
Right. They inherited the weapons from the Soviet Union, and they gave them back to Russia in great cooperation with the United States. And again, that's in such contrast, and it's such a pity to where we are today. Now, the things that we learned from those successes then have to be applied very carefully to what we have today. For example, if we look at North Korea and say, well, just let them do what Libya did, and that is to just give up their nuclear program. Well, Libya and Gaddafi had almost nothing. They had a few crates of centrifuges that were indeed shipped to the United States. North Korea has a substantial nuclear program. It has dozens and missile program, dozens of sites, hundreds of buildings, thousands of people, and it has weapons, it has plutonium, it has highly enriched uranium, it has the hydrogen bomb fuels. That's an entirely different situation. So yes, there were successes, but now we have to be much smarter as to how do we deal with countries like North Korea.
Nice to talk to you again. Siegfried Hecker, who's senior fellow at the Center for International Security and Cooperation and emeritus director of the Los Alamos National Laboratory, speaking to us by Skype. Thank you again, Professor.
Thank you, Lisa.
This podcast and following message are sponsored by ZipRecruiter. Are you hiring? Every business needs great people and a way to find them. Something more than posting your job online and just praying for the right people to see it. ZipRecruiter revolutionized hiring. Their technology finds great candidates for you. It learns what you're looking for, identifies people with the right experience, and invites them to apply to your job. Right now, listeners can try it for free at ZipRecruiter.com/here. That's /HERE. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire.
And today is Marathon Monday in Boston. Runners are going on in the 122nd annual road race, competing in tough conditions with colder than average temperatures and driving rain and wind. Joining us now from near the finish line is Here and Now's Alex Ashlock. Hi, Alex.
Hey, Eric. How you doing?
I'm well, thanks. So we've got some winners in a few categories. Tell us about the men's and women's winners so far.
Yeah, really a historic day here at the Boston Marathon. Japan's Yuki Kawauchi won the men's race. He's the first Japanese winner in Boston since 1987. The Japanese have a strong distance running tradition. He demonstrated that today. And, of course, Japan is hosting the 2020 Olympics coming up in a couple of years, so they're putting themselves in good position to run strong in the marathon in 2020. Also, history on the women's side in the women's race today. An American, Des Linden, won the race. She's the first American woman to win the Boston Marathon since 1985. She's run very well here in numerous other years. She was fourth last year, also recorded a second-place finish in 2011. So she broke through today with the victory. And again, she's the first American woman to win the Boston Marathon since 1985.
American woman wins since 85. It's great. Also, the wheelchair racers have, you know, been a long popular part of the Boston Marathon. Tell us about the winners there.
Well, we had a repeat champion in the men's race today, Marcel Hug. He's from Switzerland. He won the Boston Marathon last year as well. And I was going to mention the times for the women and men in the elite marathon. The men's time was actually faster than last year, despite the conditions. The
really?
Women's time much slower. And the wheelchair races were a little bit the same. Both the men's and women's wheelchair races much slower than normal because of the conditions. Marcel Hug winning the men's race from Switzerland, and Tatjana McFadden, an American wheelchair racer who has won this race now four times, recorded the victory today. She came back from some very serious health problems last year, had some surgery for some blood clots, and now she's on the comeback trail. She told me the other day she was about 85% before the race, but she performed at about 100%, I'd say, today because she won it.
So, Alex, for the elite runners, I mean, the steady rain and strong wind, it really didn't affect their race times and the outcome that much?
Well, on the women's side, it did affect the race, I think. It was much slower than last year. But on the men's side, the winning time was actually faster than last year's winning time. So it's I don't really know what happened there, but I can tell you that the conditions were just horrible. I mean, I've been covering this race for 20 years, and I've never seen conditions as poor as this. I mean, the rain was just pelting the runners at times during the race, and the wind was blowing basically in their face the whole way. So I'd say just some amazing performances given the conditions today. And now there are, you know, there are hundreds, thousands of runners out there right now who are still finishing their races. So they're having, you know, they're facing bad conditions as well. So a tough day here at the Boston Marathon.
Alex, this is the fifth anniversary of the Boston Marathon bombing. I mean, what are you hearing, if anything, of how, you know, how much is this on the minds of some of the runners and the spectators out there?
You know, Eric, I think it's just something that's going to be part of the race's history from now on. It's been 5 years. It's just remembered. It's just part of the history of the race now, and I think it's always in the backs of the minds of people who are running and participating and connected to the Boston Marathon.
Here and now is Alex Ashlock from the finish line of the Boston Marathon. Thank you, Alex.
You're welcome, Eric.
Among the 30,000 participants in today's Boston Marathon are those who've overcome physical challenges, wheelchair racers, cancer survivors, visually impaired runners who race with a sighted guide. Adventurer Eric Weinmayer also doesn't let physical challenges get in the way of his goals. In 2001, he became the first blind man to summit Mount Everest. He then completed the seven summits, climbing the highest point of all seven continents. And in 2014, Eric Weinmayer kayaked all 277 miles of the Grand Canyon. He was helped only by guides communicating with him through radios. Here's a bit of sound of his epic and dangerous trip.
Hard right, hard right, hard right. Charge.
Eric Weinmayer wrote about his journey in his 2017 book, No Barriers, A Blind Man's Journey to Kayak the Grand Canyon, which is out now in paperback. He spoke with us about the book last year and about losing his sight to a rare degenerative disease when he was in his teens.
I went blind just before my freshman year in high school, and that was a crazy feeling of literally not being able to take a step and then being led into school for the first time as a newly blinded person, being led around from class to class and being led to the bathroom. I remember sitting in the cafeteria. I'd sit there, you know, like I didn't want to sit next to anyone. I'd sat at a table by myself, and I'd listen to all the excitement and laughter and joy, you know, like food fights and fun things happening around me. And, you know, definitely going blind was a fear, but not being in the food fights, not being in the thick of things, like thinking I was going to be swept to the sidelines in this dark place and left there in this sort of kind of like a prison, that was like 100 times scarier than blackness.
You write that when you were 16, you discovered rock climbing, and that helped bring you out. Tell us about what that did for you emotionally and physically.
Opposed to sitting in the cafeteria, rock climbing was incredible. It was a sensory experience of feeling the different fissures and holds and cracks and pockets in the rock and not being able to see them, but using my hands as my eyes and feeling my way up the rock face, like this sort of hidden map in the rock, and then getting to the top and listening to this valley below me. Blind people listen to sound, you know, the vibrations of sound that echo off of things and move through space, and it's a really beautiful sense. And listening to that valley and the sound of space and the trees blowing, I just thought, this is adventure. Like, and that was cool because that created the trajectory of my life. And 16 years later, I was standing at 29,000 feet. So it was a long road, but it started moving me in the right direction.
In 2001, when you were on the summit of Everest, you accomplished what no blind person had done before. But your expedition leader turned to you and said, "Don't make Everest be the greatest thing you do." How did that motivate you?
It was the greatest advice anyone could have done for
me.
But
hard to take at that time. You're all, you're burned off, out,
like,
and
you're
feeling
thinking,
on top of the world.
PV, terrible timing. Like, let me go home and relax and celebrate. And, you know, most people are dreaming about all the comforts of home. I was dreaming about walking down a nice, smooth sidewalk that wouldn't kill me. And what he was saying was that these successes in our lives, these sort of pivotal moments in our lives, you go home and you hang your pictures and you get your awards, and you know, and then that room becomes a funeral. Like, it becomes the thing that you look back on instead of, you know, how do I move forward? How do I take those successes and use them as springboards to launch you into these new, surprising, exciting directions?
Let's turn to the challenge that's at the center of your book, Kayaking the Grand Canyon. Just the physical challenges of kayaking without being able to see the water. Take us through what's involved for you in learning to kayak.
As a blind person, you know, I couldn't look at like old Wide World of Sports videos of people kayaking. So you have to learn kinesthetically. One of the ways you learn is get yourself in the middle of that thing and ride that energy. And kayaking was an incredible sensory experience. Sometimes it felt like sensory overload because you're getting knocked over left and right and you're rolling up and I don't know which way I'm facing. And I got to whip my boat around and just take those waves, these forces that are so much bigger than you. And then you're riding a line, too. You know, every rapid sort of has a map, and they call it the line. And so you, just like that rock face, you're trying to navigate that line. You never quite achieve that line unless you're really lucky, especially when you're blind. You're doing more reacting than acting.
It's incredibly hard when you're sighted. I've been on less intense rivers just doing some rafting, and just to find your way, look ahead and try to understand and read the river is just incredibly difficult. You talk about how you start out on a lake and then move to a section of the Green River, and finally you're there at Lava Falls in the Grand Canyon, and that goes pretty tough. I mean, it's you're sort of upside down most of the time. Take us through that falls.
Yeah, I mean, there are harder rapids, but this is the biggest rapid in the Grand Canyon, and in a canyon known for giant rapids, and I got in my boat and just got hammered. Even my guide, Harlan, who had done the Grand Canyon 100 times or more, he knew every rapid and every water level. You know, he braced his paddle against one of these massive waves, and it busted his carbon fiber paddle in half and knocked him over. He was upside down, blood pouring out his nose, shattered paddle, trying to roll up, trying to communicate with me, just getting hammered under, you know, thousands of pounds of water, trying to roll up, listening for Harlan's directions. There's definitely, in kayaking, different from mountains. Mountains, you can stop and you can sort of regain control. You can take these potentially uncontrollable situations and kind of bring them under control in your mind. Kayaking is the same thing, but there's never full control. It's a great lesson for kind of a controller like me, because it was as much about letting go and just trying to ride these forces that are so massive. They're bigger than anything you could imagine.
Mm-hmm. Eric, you're not just doing this for thrills. And we should point out, you have a team and you use radios and some other high-tech devices to help you. But, you know, sometimes those radios break frequently and you're on your own.
Well, I should also say that I have an amazing team. So I don't see myself as a blind daredevil. You know, I've never seen myself as like a blind Evel Knievel, just taking massive amounts of risk. And yeah, you definitely are on your own sometimes. And there's a lot of flailing and slamming into rocks and pulling your skirt and swimming for your life. And that's part of the learning process. You know, like, I wish growth in our lives were like a nice, neat arc and a nice crescendo at the top. And then, you know, like, everyone goes home like watching a movie. It's not. It's messy. And one of the things that I was really fascinated by in this experience was, how do you go from, you know, sitting at that cafeteria when I was a kid to experiencing life fully? The map that you create is so uncertain. It's so dark. And nobody, I thought, had ever adequately illuminated what that map looked like for people. And so for me, 100%, being in a rapid is messy, and things go wrong. Radios stop when you least expect it. Going into one rapid, it's like funny now when I think about it, because we were testing different radios. And a second before I went into the rapid, it stopped working. And I'm screaming, "No radios, no radios." And my friend Rob is behind me, paddling furiously, trying to get to me, screaming, "Plan B," which is just get right behind me and yell at the top of his lungs. I'm like, you know, life is so insane sometimes. Right. But that's the kind of stuff you have to work through if you want to wind up sort of being in the thick of things and living this life that matters.
When you finished kayaking the Grand Canyon, how did you feel? Were you spent and tired, or were you already looking for your next challenge?
Well, you are tired for sure. I'd been kayaking for 20 days. My family met me. They drove down this long dirt road, flew into Phoenix and drove all the way there. My son, my daughter, my wife, they were there right on the shore. And so when I pulled in, they were there. I hugged my wife, and even the head Sherpa on my Everest expedition, Kami, was there. Hmm. And Harlan, who's guiding me down the river, he broke down in tears. And that was a lot of responsibility because he wanted to show me his home, this beautiful canyon that had become his home. But yet at the same time, Harlan was getting knocked over and trying to roll up and look, and where's Eric, and trying to navigate me through. And so there was a lot of pressure on his shoulders and on my team. So for him to get me through safely was just an incredible feeling for everyone, not just for me.
Eric Weinmayer's new book is No Barriers, A Blind Man's Journey to Kayak the Grand Canyon. Eric, it was a pleasure speaking with you and reading your book. Thank you.
Thank you. Enjoy it.
Athlete Eric Weinmayer spoke with us last year.
Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe is heading to President Trump's Florida estate, Mar-a-Lago, for a two-day visit that starts tomorrow. They're expected to talk about trade and North Korea in preparation for a possible meeting next month between President Trump and North Korea's leader Kim Jong-un. Celia Hatton is Asia-Pacific editor for the BBC. Celia, welcome to Here and Now.
Hello, thank you.
Could you set the scene for us first? Japan is an important U.S. ally. The alliance, though, has been strained over several issues. What is the reason for this meeting tomorrow with Donald Trump and Shinzo Abe?
Well, this is a key meeting for Shinzo Abe because really, politically, diplomatically, he and his country have been left out in the cold following what seemed to be quite a sudden announcement from the Trump administration that Donald Trump would engage in direct talks with Kim Jong-un. And apparently they were not consulted ahead of this announcement, ahead of this decision. This was a bit of a shock for the Japanese. They really thought that they had a very, very close relationship with Donald Trump. Shinzo Abe was famously the first world leader to fly to New York after Donald Trump was elected. He had a 90-minute meeting with Donald Trump at the time. He was then the first foreign leader to be officially invited to Mar-a-Lago to visit Donald Trump in Florida. And so I think the Japanese really were kind of sitting back and feeling quite comfortable, thinking that they had developed a very special relationship, which really was sort of blown out of the water when that surprise announcement came from the Trump administration that direct talks would take place.
Right. I think a lot of parties, both domestically and internationally, were surprised that those direct talks might take place between Donald Trump and the leader of North Korea. Japan has skin in this game, though. Japan has been very concerned about the missiles that North Korea has launched, including one last November, an intercontinental ballistic missile that certainly put a lot of fear in the United States, but also traveled about 600 miles, landed in the Sea of Japan. So Shinzo Abe is extremely concerned about any kind of talks that happen between the U.S. and North Korea. What is he expected to ask Donald Trump to do?
He's expected to ask for a few things. Really, he's going to be pushing Donald Trump not to make a quick deal with the North Koreans. He's going to be pushing Donald Trump not to sign a peace treaty with North Korea, which really would effectively accept North Korea as a nuclear state. Japan has long pushed for denuclearization, but also really for North Korea to rein in other missiles. Japan feels very vulnerable, and they do not want Donald Trump to forget them and to forget their plight.
To what extent, though, realistically, could Shinzo Abe expect that Donald Trump would integrate Japan's concerns in any talks that may take place with North Korea?
That's a good point. So what the real fear is that Donald Trump will push Shinzo Abe to link security with trade, because what Donald Trump wants is for the United States and Japan to negotiate a free trade agreement. He's been pushing for this for a long time. Japan has a quite large trade surplus with the United States that has bothered Donald Trump for quite a long time. And I think really the fear in Tokyo is that Donald Trump will say, okay, I will listen to your security concerns when it comes to North Korea, but you have to do me a favor and let's start negotiating a free trade deal, which the Japanese don't want, because really Japan's economy isn't doing terribly well. And so they don't want trade and security to be linked in these talks.
And one other area of friction, of course, tariffs, because the Trump administration has imposed tariffs on steel and aluminum imports, but carved out temporary exemptions for six countries, for the European Union, not for Japan, and that angers Shinzo Abe. Why was Japan excluded from those exemptions, and what kind of trade agreement could Abe be looking for with Donald Trump?
Well, I don't think we've received a very good explanation as to why Japan was excluded. And I think many people in Japan were really dismayed. We go back to this special relationship that Shinzo Abe thought that he had with Donald Trump. And yes, Japan was the only major U.S. ally to not receive an exemption from these steel and aluminum tariffs. I think, again, it's believed that the reason that an exemption hasn't been granted yet is because really Donald Trump wants to start negotiating a U.S.-Japan free trade agreement. And that's what he's going to push for when the two leaders meet tomorrow.
So one more question, and this has to do with the protests that have been happening in Japan. The Japanese aren't known as coming out in large numbers often to protest against their government. They have done it. They've been doing it recently because of corruption scandals around Japan's prime minister. His approval rating has dropped significantly. What is the stake Donald Trump has if Shinzo Abe is forced out of office or loses the next election?
I think both men, frankly, are dealing with problems domestically. Both men have low approval ratings. And in that sense, both are pushing for a big political win. So, yes, you're right. Shinzo Abe's approval ratings are quite low. He's really becoming engulfed in quite a few scandals, actually. But it's interesting. You can draw quite a few parallels between the two. And so I think they both have quite high stakes entering into this summit.
Celia Hatton, Asia-Pacific editor for the BBC. Thanks a lot, Celia.
Thank you.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Lisa Mullins.
And I'm Eric Westervelt. It's Here and Now.